Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. My name is Lori, and I'm joined today by Kat, who you've heard on the show before. Kat's joining us from Scotland and has their PhD in all sorts of hard science kind of things that I can't even begin to explain. So I'll have Kat explain that for you. But we really wanted to have a conversation about research and how like qualitative research differs so much from the quantitative and like that hard sciences. I know people don't usually like that word, but hard sciences that Kat does, and how we can share information to try and improve mental health care for everyone. I think is that a fair statement about what we're going to talk about?
That's awesome.
Beautiful. Awesome. Well, Kat, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in research?
So I sort of sidestepped sciences, but I originally did my master's level research in mass spectrometry, actually, in analytical chemistry. And then that led me into my PhD, which was using mass spectrometry to look at proteomics in infection biology. So what happens to a cell after it's infected, basically, which proteins does it switch off, which proteins does it switch on? Because of the nature of how proteins are analyzed, that requires a lot of computing to get meaningful data out of it. So I ended up doing a benchmarking study, comparing different computer programs and checking that they got a consensus about which proteins were actually there and how much agreement there was, and statistics to analyze that, which was a great surprise to me that I would end up creating a statistical method when I am dyscalculic, but that was lots of fun. But yeah, so I've sort of then gone on to sort of think about mental health and try and move into that field. But that kind of, yeah, so that intersection of the qualitative and the quantitative is quite fascinating for me. So that's my motivation for this.
Yeah, what you do is like so quantitative that I'm like, oh my God, my brain can't even comprehend. I am the kind of person who like every time I take a stats class, I end up crying. Like, and I do well in them all. It's really weird. I just like can't emotionally deal with it for some reason.
Yeah, I have like an automatic fear of numbers too.
Yeah, which is funny.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of like the theory of it is so fascinating. And yet the actual computation of it is just very overwhelming.
Totally. And when did you do your PhD or finish it?
I finished it in 2015.
Oh, wow. Okay. So quite a long time ago. And did you have a BPD diagnosis at that point?
I did not. No.
Okay. You do now though, right?
Complex PTSD, but as EUPD and PTSD. So yeah. So basically, yes.
Right. Okay. Yeah, EUPD. I feel like that's, honestly, I like that language a lot better, the emotionally unstable personality disorder, right? That's what that is. Yeah. That's not used in North America.
No, it's in, yeah, it's because it's in the ICD, but it's not in the DSM.
Right. Yeah. Duh. That makes sense.
Yes. It's not diagnostic language, but yeah, it's.
Yeah. It's much more
descriptive.
Yeah. Like accurate. Yeah. Than borderline. Yeah. I would be curious. Like, I know the DSM is kind of notoriously complex to try and change, but like, you know, they do revisions. Like maybe one day it will change the language. Cause does the EUPD, this is a total side note, that it's not what we were supposed to be talking about, but I'm very curious. Does the EUPD criteria include like all of the BPD criteria?
Pretty much. It was a similar 9.
Okay.
It's very slightly different wording, but similar 9. But actually, the interesting thing is the ICD-11 is also moving into the new model of personality disorders, which acknowledges that if you meet the criteria for one, you probably at some point on your scale from organized to disorganized will meet the criteria for some, if not all, other personality disorders.
Great.
Well, yeah,
let's just exactly. Add to
it's
our list.
Like, it's kind of like, well, maybe, but also that sounds like just one big bucket for everybody. But
and like over pathologizing, maybe like pathologizing on paper for very little benefit, I would think could be an outcome of that.
Yeah, it's kind of saying that, yeah, that like it's just the personality is disordered and not defining in what way. So is that more or less stigma is another whole question. And interestingly, the only one that was an exception was that they can say with borderline traits. Because a lot of people on the review panel were like, but what about borderlines? How are we going to define that? Because we need to know. And it's like, well, why do you need to know? Particularly that. So, but anyway, no, that's fascinating. Tangent. But
yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Wow. That's super interesting. I'm trying to trying to process because like, obviously labeling people are for or against it. I'm personally for it if it benefits the patient. So if the patient finds value in having a label or they can find better treatment or more accurate treatment, then like by all means, I'm fine with that. But if you're kind of not, you're just saying like, well, you're messed up, but not providing any like clarity around why or how or what we can do about it.
Yeah, I think it's moving towards having, I forget the name of it now, I should have looked up, but there is like a test that is like just all of the personality disorder traits. And it's kind of moving towards that model where it's like more individualized for the actual person. So it's like you have these traits from there and then these traits from there. And, you know, if you get distressed, you're going to go up in these traits and that kind of thing. So that it looks like it's thinking about more individualized care, but whether it actually worked out in that way is a whole other thing.
Yeah. And if it actually provides care in the end.
Yeah, because right? obviously like, it's a massive gatekeeper, not in the same way that it is in the US, but like, so here it's more like you have to meet criteria to get anything.
Yeah, same with Canada, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So and like what you get kind of relates directly to your level of distress and or hassling of services.
Truth.
Which is bad. But yeah, it's going to, I don't know. It's one of those weird things where, again, it's exactly the kind of point that like things happen in academia and then filter down in some ways, but not in others. And then, and it's very delayed and all that kind of thing. It's just, yeah.
Yes.
So all the ICD stuff is very new, so it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I was pleasantly surprised that CPTSD was on the table for the psychiatrist that I was seeing, because that's quite a new thing.
Yeah, I actually don't know if that's even in the DSM, is it?
It's not.
Yeah.
It's not. Bessel van der Kolk tried to get developmental trauma because he worked with Judith Herman, who wrote Trauma and Recovery, which talks about complex PTSD. And yeah, they tried to get that in the DSM, but it was not taken up.
Well, and my understanding of complex PTSD is that it's like reoccurring trauma, right? As opposed to like a one incident. Is that, I mean, obviously I'm sure there's like many more caveats to that, but that's generally speaking the difference.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. So something that is repeated and you're kind of aware that it's going to happen, but you can't get out of it.
Right. So childhood trauma is absolutely that, because
absolutely included in that, but it would also include like abusive relationships and,
or even like being a paramedic or something where you're seeing trauma constantly and that's what you got to do.
Yeah. It's sort of also assumes that it links into your cognitive view of yourself. So yeah, certainly that could become complex, but it'd be less likely to, because it's kind of that.
Interesting.
I'm good at tangent.
We're going on all sorts of tangents that I know, I love it. So I guess the way that this conversation kind of came about was I had sent you my, or it was on Patreon or something, sent you my master's research. Funnily enough, I really haven't talked about it a lot on this podcast, which makes no sense because I really should be talking about it all the time because I think A, it's really cool, and B, it's directly related to what we're doing. So maybe I'll just give like a 2-second overview of what I did, and then we can talk a little bit about your reflections on it and just the conversation that we were having. So So I was doing my master's in health administration, which is kind of like a MBA, but healthcare specific. So master's of, yeah, health administration. And so that really means like looking at kind of the, like not the clinical side of healthcare as much, but really looking at like how healthcare operates and how we can improve the system from like that level of like operations. With that, we did, it wasn't technically a thesis, it was a capstone project, but it was like essentially, at least for my project, like very much research being done. And the nice thing about that program is you can kind of make health administration anything, because everything in healthcare in any way relates to like, you know, cost saving and how we can like provide services in the way that the clients actually need them, and patient-centered care and inclusion and all this stuff. So it was really great, because I was like, okay, well, I want to do something that I am like super passionate about, that's not going to feel like I'm just like trying to get this research done. I want to actually be excited about it. So I chose to do a qualitative research project about the Super Feelers Club, which is our peer support group that we run. And I was really thankful that they let me do that, because obviously there is like some sort of bias around the fact that like we created this and we run it and whatever. But also there's so much value in having, I can't remember the exact words now, but there's like theories around like the fact that qualitative researchers should be as ingrained in their own field of study as possible, because then you actually have like a more well-rounded view of what the responses are and what the realities are for the people. So I was lucky that my program didn't like try and talk me out of it at all. My supervisor did talk me out of doing like a mixed method, because I wanted to do some quantitative as well. And I'm glad he did, because it like at the end of the day, he was like, that's too much. He's like, you're going to regret doing that. It's not going to provide enough value that like you're not going to have big enough numbers. Like just do qualitative. It's super valuable to have qualitative. And so what I did was I interviewed, I think like 13 people who had participated in the Super Feelers Club. Some of them had been there for like one session. Some of them had been there at all of the sessions. This was almost 2 years ago now, which is kind of crazy. So we hadn't had as many sessions as we had now, but I think like 13 sessions was maybe how many we'd had at that time. And basically started with some general questions around like their experiences with BPD. What it really ended up looking like was everybody's story really fell into like four main components. So it was like their experience with diagnosis, and that experience was either positive, negative, or like neutral. So some people didn't really have a strong reaction to getting their diagnosis because they had no idea what it was. Whereas other people who had like worked in healthcare or had a lot of stigma were just like automatically like, nope, that's not me. I'm super against this diagnosis. And then other people were like, finally, there's something that I can actually do about this. Like everything makes sense. So it was really cool to see that kind of clear groups of people based on their previous information about borderline. And then the other kind of main kind of topic area that we ended up with was what treatment looked like for them. Some people had opportunities to go to things like dialectical behavior therapy, others hadn't. And then that was really important to understand, because when we moved into talking about peer support specifically, some people had experiences with like group therapy and DBT. And so peer support was kind of familiar to them. Other people had no experience with groups at all, no experience with DBT skills at all. But obviously, because they're self-selecting to participate in the Super Feelers Club, they were very much interested in learning skills. And so one of the cool things that came up was like people would join the Super Feelers Club, start kind of hearing about DBT skills. And even though they didn't have access to their own primary treatment team or anything like that, they were like going out and buying the books on Amazon and doing the skills, which I think is like amazing. It's like a $30 investment for people to actually like want to learn the skills, right? And then we talked about what recovery meant too. So there was some like quality improvement stuff that I was looking at in terms of the Super Feelers Club too, because I really want to make sure that that program is the best possible. And there's so little research about BPD peer support. So I had to take some findings of like other kind of mental health peer support models and try and like see how they could relate. But there is just like a difference with BPD because of all the interpersonal stuff. So yeah, it was really interesting. And then we talked about recovery. And so some people felt like recovery was super something that they were already in or that they were striving for. Other people were like, nope, this is just who I am. Recovery looked like such a variety of things to people, which was also really beautiful to see. So that, long story short, that was kind of the research overall. And so the qualitative piece of it is really like sharing the stories of these individuals. And so there was a lot of like direct quotes from participants in the paper. And there's also a lot of like summarizing of, you know, generally speaking, these are the three groups that people fell into or whatever. So you want to share your thoughts on it when you read it?
I love the whole premise of it, just to start with. And the idea that just going into maybe making peer support something that is studyable, that is talked about, that is, you know, presented as something that is valuable and yet inherently difficult to measure. And that's exactly the point, because like you will always have small groups or a large variety or very similar but not the same groups. And it's rare to have access to numbers that would be able to make it quantitative. And I can totally see where that was going, because because it's one of those things, like people are very into power analyses and you need big numbers for those.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just loved its honesty, the way that it, you know, maximized people's voices and that point of what exactly support is, what exactly recovery is. And it almost opened up so many questions around that and the discussion around that and the magic of that being available to other people, because that's exactly what the peer support is seeing your experience mirrored in someone else, which like when you're dealing with emotional dysregulation or you've had trauma or whatever is going on, like that is not something that you often see mirrored in your general life. So having those spaces where you can just be honest about that, and you're almost forced into being very, not calculated, but being very direct and open about everything that's going on, because there is that acknowledgement that you're always going to be triggering each other and yourself.
Totally.
Whenever you're investing in that self-investigation and, you know, looking at problems and issues and how everyone is thinking.
Yeah. And I think like that's where having a researcher that lives with borderline is important, because like trying to describe those dynamics, analyze data in a way that understands those dynamics, I feel like it could very easily become like a more pathologized view.
Yeah.
Right. Because there were times where like some of the, I know one participant was like, yeah, I get pissed off by people in the group. Like they drive me nuts. I don't want to, you know, and like, I knew because of how our conversation went that like, that was actually a positive thing. Cause that was them being able to recognize like, oh, these people have traits that really drive me nuts, but I'm still going to try and come because that's an important way for me to practice skills. But you could also look at like, well, they hated people in the group, period. And it's very different.
Yeah, exactly. But it's that opposite. It's that intentional opposite action of, I want to be able to connect with these people, but that is going to inherently going to be opening up those things that are the exact things that I struggle with.
Totally. And like even analyzing the data was tough for me because it was triggering as well, right? Like, you know, you're...
It's like meta-triggering.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you're reading people. And I should say, in terms of analyzing the data, I did it like all by hand. So I didn't use like any software, which software probably would have made it less triggering because it's kind of doing some of that for you. But I didn't like that. I like to be really like in it. You know what I mean? Like it takes forever. I'm like, you know, highlighting things 100,000 times. I'm putting sticky notes all over my wall, like all of these things. But at the end of the day, like, I need to be embedded into their stories somehow and like really understand like how things connect. Whereas I don't feel like software can do a super good job of that. And to be fair, the like qualitative method that I was using didn't agree with using technology either. So that was kind of helpful.
Yeah, because context is important, right?
Totally. Yeah, exactly. And also, like, I really, really wanted to use this as an opportunity to have the voices of people with borderline shared.
Yeah. I think it almost kind of mirrors back to consciousness raising groups of like the women's movement and, you know, other movements where it's been, you know, these are actually the voices of our experience.
Totally.
And there has to be that safe space of sharing before you can speak out about it, because that you have to kind of distill. I think exactly as you did in there, it's like it's distilling the experience of the many into an example of experience that can then be identified with by even more, which is magical.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have like 400,000 quotes, right? I wanted to just like, here's the full transcripts. Obviously, that wasn't going to happen. So trying to like narrow it down was so hard because I wanted to find examples that were kind of resonating with the overall themes.
Yeah.
But that also showed the like very different views and ways of talking about those themes.
Did you group multiple quotes by theme, or did you kind of amalgamate quotes into exemplars?
So what I did was when I was going through the themes, and I had two other coders because I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just my perspective. So when we were going through the themes, I said, like, you know, as you're pulling out key themes, if you are going through your transcripts and seeing like, this is a great example of this theme, pull it out, highlight it. And then at the end, I'll collate them all together and be like, okay, well, I can't have 15 different quotes for this theme. So what are the like top three that really showcase what this is? And then I also tried to make sure that because the sample was so small, that I wasn't just using the same person over and over again. And so I would assume, I don't actually remember now, but I would assume that I probably had at least one quote from each participant.
Wow.
But yeah, there were so many that I had to cut. I presented the research at a conference last year and like I only had 15 minutes. And so even then I had to cut. It was brutal. It was like so brutal. And so I had to cut even more quotes because like my entire PowerPoint when I first put it together was like just quotes, because I was like, this is what the important part is like hearing their voices. And then I was like, no, but I actually need to talk about like the methods and all of the actual stuff. And so, yeah, it was really hard for me to pull those out because my whole thing in like life, obviously this podcast is a good example of that, is like our voices matter and they're valid and our experiences are valid and we need to be able to share those in a safe space. And like, I think this research was a safe space for the majority of participants. I didn't hear any issues with it. And so if I can go and share in a safe way quotes from this research, then like that's what I want to do. Because yeah, I can go to a conference and talk about my experience over and over and over again, been there, done that, but like my experience is unique, every single person's experience is unique, so I don't want to become like the voice of people. Because I think like that's easy for health systems to do, is be like, oh, like Lori's the kid with borderline, so like we're gonna just pick her. And it's like, totally great, but like can I bring three other people? Because I can't be the only voice of borderline in the health system in my province. That's just like not okay.
That's so cool to kind of acknowledge that bigger picture and bring that in and see how that affects the system. That's very astute.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think like the thing that really we want to talk about here, and I actually have an episode coming out, or it will have already come out, but it hasn't yet, with a researcher who does borderline research in Toronto. Yeah, you'll love it. I'm like, I know for a fact you're gonna love that. But she talks a lot about how, like, you know, research is gatekept. And I mean, I totally agree. I think anybody that like understands academia knows that that is absolutely a problem. But like sharing this information is so difficult. And especially with qualitative methods, people don't give qualitative methods the like credit that they deserve. Yep. So I have like, it's been on my to-do list for like 2 months, is like, where can I publish this? Because it needs to get out there. It should be a resource. It's providing like clear benefit, or like clear examples of benefit of peer support And also takes into consideration like the cost to the health system that people with borderline are, which I mean, I hate to look at it in like numbers like that, but we cost a lot. And so peer support is such a cheap option for support. And like, that was kind of how I tied it back into the health administration kind of side of things. Cause I was just like, this is actually a no brainer.
Yeah. Like, cheap and yet so valuable.
Exactly. And if people are doing peer support and then intentionally going out and learning skills, you're skipping a step. Like, they're coming into DBT with already a baseline information about what the skills are, which is going to make them more successful, which is going to make them not have to be readmitted to hospital as often. And like, you know, we could go on forever.
Exactly. And in those moments when, you know, it's a struggle to use the skills, you've got like, oh yeah, but I know so-and-so and they're really committed to it and they're okay. And they said they feel like this sometimes, but generally it's working. And it's like, it's having that role model as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a no-brainer. Yet.
But publishing is so hard because it's, you know, you've got the tiered journals and, you know, something that's qualitative is unlikely to get into a top tier journal. But if you publish in, you know, a nursing journal or a procedural journal, who is going to see that? You know, do you go and publish on something like Medium, but then that's not going to have the clout of there's something like that. And it's that whole kind of ball game, because obviously if you did publish on something like Medium, then you are no longer eligible to publish in a journal, and which again is a whole other issue. Yeah. And then the whole elitism of the system as well. There are several directions
totally.
There.
Oh my God. It's atrocious. And like, there's days where I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to put this on my website, like my personal website, because I just want the information to get out there. But then you have that like, oh, well, who's saying that this has been peer reviewed and who's saying that this is legitimate? And it's like, well,
because you have that integrity where you want it to go out there as something that someone else can riff off and build on and do more research about.
Yeah, exactly. But people aren't going to find it if they're searching, you know, journal databases. They're not going to find it if it's not in a journal. Yeah. So yeah, it's this like constant back and forth of like, do I put the effort in to try and mold to the system that they want me to mold to?
Because then of course every journal will have its own way of writing, which will have to be rewritten to fit.
Exactly.
Which is a whole other issue.
Yeah, totally. I'm working on another publication for like a work thing, and it's that journal is like actually super chill, which is nice. But I don't think that my research necessarily fits their journal because it's like a very specific thing. But anyways, but it's like, yeah, trying to rewrite it to fit exactly what they're doing is like daunting, because and like to make it fit within word limits, because
it's a process. It's like writing a book, you know, you send it in, they say, you know, even if they accept it, they usually send it back with corrections or you know, we'd like you to write a bit more about this, go and research that for a while, or you know, we don't want that bit in here, and then it becomes a discussion. It's it's a commitment trying to publish in a journal.
Yeah. But I like, it's so valuable, right? And like,
exactly.
And
it's definitely worth it, but it's a lot.
Yeah. And then it's, you know, it's no wonder that people, you know, there's not more researchers that are open about borderline that I can find in in databases and that kind of thing. There's like one who did her master's many, many years ago that I think has borderline, but it's not even said, it's just like implied.
No. Yeah, exactly. And then also like a lot of borderline research is related to inpatient populations, which is not going to be representative of everybody, certainly not everybody all of the time.
I mean, no research
is like perpetuates the stigma.
Yeah,
so.
Totally. Yeah. I mean,
because it's like, no, well, everyone is at that extreme level all the time. Or that's not what you got. And it's like, no, actually it's not that simple.
Totally. And that's where the stigma that is so ingrained into our health system and our society about borderline is, I think, the reason why peer support for borderline doesn't exist. And like
that and the, yeah, the perceived risk.
Yeah, well, exactly. That, but I think that's the same thing.
Of anybody talking to anybody else.
Yeah, right? But like I think
anyone who has mental health issues should not talk to anybody else with mental health issues, because that's dangerous. And it's just short-sighted and focusing on liability and not finding something that actually gives value to people.
Totally. And like the irony is we have had, I don't even know, like, let's say like 50 super feeler sessions and have had no like periods of like crisis or extreme risk that we needed to deal with. We have a process to deal with it because we know how to do it.
Yeah.
But we've never had an issue where there's something horrible happened. Knock on wood, obviously. Like, I hope that never happens. But
exactly. But I think it's like, you know, it's something that you can look forward to, mm-hmm. you can value. It's a space where you can be in front of other people and not have to hide. And that is just, the value of that is immeasurable.
Yeah.
But also you start respecting that space because it's so valuable. And then it becomes a place to practice that opposite action. And so those things just, you know, you find yourself able to manage those things.
Mm-hmm. And you're self-selecting to be there.
Exactly. And then, you know, that teaches you that you can manage that stuff. And then that goes out into life. And then you come back even more well-equipped to, you know, deal with the next session. It's just, like you say, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, totally. And like, years and years ago, like probably in like 2015, 2014, something like that, one of the local health authorities had a conversation with me about peer support for borderline. Like this was way back, long before Bold Beautiful Borderline, long before Super Feelers Club, whatever. And I was like, yep, I'm down. Like, let's get it done. Like, I will support this 100%. Like, you tell me what you need from me. I will be there 100% of the time. I'm fully committed to this. And then it became like, okay, well, we just need to go check in with our like liability, like our risk management team. Crickets, never heard from them again.
Nothing.
And it's like, okay, so what you're telling me by not doing this is that the potential of you getting sued is worse than the potential of us living in horrific pain forever.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying.
Exactly. And that should not be their priority, because their priority should be care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, again, I think that very rarely, if people are self-selecting to be there, you will have problems.
Exactly.
It's different if you're forcing people to go. Don't get me wrong. Like that is different.
Because that in itself is traumatic.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
But no, do you have like, so here, you're starting to see kind of peer workers within, particularly within charities and partly within sort of the NHS and companies as well. Is that the same over there?
Yeah, it is. But it's, at least my understanding of it at this point, is it's very like general, right? Like it's like, I'm a mental health peer support worker, as opposed to like, I'm a peer support worker who understands your experience with borderline. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's not.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it's the same. It's mostly general. Though there are starting to be some. I did a quick search, and there are starting to be some that are particularly bipolar seems to have more of a presence of peer support. But yeah, so that's kind of quietly optimistic on that front. But yeah,
totally. For you, are there many groups that are run by like the NHS? Or is it often like individual peer support?
As mostly it would be one-to-one that I've seen. Yeah. And yeah, groups in general. I think my NHS area is the only area in Scotland that has personality disorder program and does DBT. But that is obviously very ring-fenced for top tier needs. So yeah, so I actually go to a DBT group that's hosted in America, which has an online community and groups through that. So,
right. Yeah.
It is amazing.
Which is amazing, but also you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever to go to group, and it's not people that understand your experience within your country, right? Like, because there are differences.
It is something that they're quite good with times, so they kind of do early in the morning over there, and so it is semi accessible, and they do lots of times. So they have three classes a week, and like two are sort of their lunchtime. One is their evening, so that's two of my evenings, and like the other one is at like midnight.
Okay, that's good.
But yeah, so it's, and then the actual groups where we're in front of each other are my evening and most other people's mornings. But it's, so it is starting to be sort of international. There's some Europeans and people from the UK and Australia and America together, and it's quite interesting having that together, because it starts to be. You start to be kind of familiar with all of those experiences, which is quite interesting.
And they're so varied.
Yeah.
So what group is that? Like, is that available for people to...
Yeah, it's called Jones Mindful Living.
Jones Mindful
Living. And it's like all of the other stuff I could find was like £250 a week. Ooh. Or something that you read online and then did yourself. And there were some videos. Whereas this is, I think it's now... like £19 a week or something, £19 a month or something.
Oh, that's like,
it's very affordable,
super reasonable.
And then like the individual coaching is extra, but again, it's very, very affordable. So I was very lucky to find it. So I kind of like your spaces, I value it very highly.
Thank you.
For its peer value. So
yeah, I just think there's something so unique about that group experience, because so many of us do need that mirror held up. To say, oh my God, this is what I'm like. And like, that was my group DBT. That was my most profound learning at the beginning, was, oh my God, that's what I'm like. And so, I mean, I think that, don't get me wrong, I think that individual peer support is amazing, and we should absolutely support that in the health system for sure. No question. But I think there's a way to add to that and really focus on inclusion of people with lived experience, facilitating groups of other people with similar experiences, because not only is it like actually more economically sound because you're paying one or two facilitators for a group of people, but also you have this relationship building that's happening outside of that professional connection of like, well, you're a peer support worker. I'm building a relationship with you, but you just work here. I think it's different when it's a community that you're building.
Yeah. Yeah, of people interacting with other people, exactly. And I am starting to kind of see it within charities. There's a few kind of peers.
Can you explain charity, like in your, like that's like nonprofit organizations that provide healthcare?
Yeah, I'm not exactly. It would depend on the legislature of nonprofit organizations. But so a charity is something that is, not a company, not a business, not a company. So,
and they're not in the NHS. They're not part of the NHS.
They are sometimes outsourced by the NHS because of the whole privatization of the NHS, which is sort of quietly going on. So some sort of stand alone and do their work. Some are partly government funded. Some are wholly government funded. Some are wholly grant funded, and then some try and use kind of grassroots fundraising. As well, like,
okay,
so it's a whole thing, and it can be a variety of different things, from a group of people who've set up a constitution so that they can have a bank account and officially fund and like fundraise with some legitimacy, to something which is essentially a big kind of company sort of model with employees, and but also bringing that money in and then using it to provide services. Sometimes those services are only signposting, which I have slight issue with, but that is also quite useful as well.
You want to talk about that a little bit? What your issue is with that?
So that would be like charity or a company who usually would run a helpline, and what they would do on their helpline would be to say, oh, have you heard of this other charity or this other thing that you could go to? So they're not actually providing services themselves. They are aware of a lot of other services that you could use.
Right. So your thought is like, well, or you could use that funding to provide services, and then we wouldn't need as many navigation supports. Is that kind of your thought?
Yeah. So like if the people providing the services had more funding, they could then advertise their services
right
better. And then you would be aware of them anyway. But anyway, that's kind of a side note. But yeah, so there's a couple of charities that I am aware of that are running peer support groups, which are very helpful, just because of that similar experience.
Yeah. And like, we need so many of them. It's not one, I don't know how it works with the charities where you are, but I know it happens in Canada where we call them nonprofits most mm-hmm. of the time, but they'll kind of get bitchy and like compete for funding.
Yes.
And like,
absolutely.
And like, they'll try and like kind of badmouth other organizations who are providing the same thing because then they will get the funding. And I think that is bullshit because like, to me, like what Jones, whatever, like I couldn't give a shit whether or not she's doing the exact same thing we're doing. As long as it's safe and I believe in what they're doing, I want them to have clients as much as I want us to have clients. I mean, not that we make money off of our clients, but I wish. But, you know, we shouldn't be bad-mouthing other providers that are doing the same thing that we are. Because like you said, you know, we don't need to have funding to like share about good resources that are available. And there's never going to be enough resources available. So like, you know, I'm actually just after this recording, I'm recording with somebody who works with Emotions Matter, who's like a big organization in the States. Like, that's great. I'm fully like, you know, bring them on.
Yeah.
And the other thing,
I think it's a bit like the AA model, you know, like if you need something and it's there, you should be able to know that it's there so that you can then access it if you need it.
Yeah. And also, like, I'm sure very similar to AA is what works for me might not work for you. So if I go to the group that runs out of the church on Tuesday afternoon at 2 p.m. and I don't like the dynamic, well, then at least there's like 50 other options that I can go to, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's pros and cons of AA, obviously, but in that sense, they have it pretty figured out in terms of like accessibility. Seems like a very good model in terms of accessibility.
And also, you know, that population also would be on paper high risk and seems to be working quite well.
and has have a lot for hundreds of years or whatever. Yeah, exactly. It's a good point. I've never thought to like argue that model, like argue that that's similar.
I don't know if it works the same over there. That's quite interesting because it's over here. It is. So AA is not generally run out of official organizations. It's very grassroots.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, by definition, it kind of subverts all of that kind of terminology and exactly, which is fantastic.
Which is what we're doing too, right? Like we don't exist really. Like have I thought about like trying to get some sort of charity status so that we could have a bank account so we could fundraise? Like, of course, but at the end of the day, like we did at one point think about partnering with another organization who did have that set up so that we could, you know, run our support groups. We realized that like actually we need it to be super flexible.
Yeah.
And working under somebody else's like requirements wasn't gonna be able to meet with our morals and values. So we just decided that like, yeah, it costs, like we're very thankful for our Patreon supporters, don't get me wrong. But like and at the end of the day, like we lose money every month on this podcast and this Super Feelers Club. So like, but to us it's worth having the space without the like harsh requirements of others, because we know that it's safe and we know that we are risk managing in a way that's actually like strength-based, as opposed to like, oh, people with borderline can't be trusted, which is really what that's what everybody else is thinking, you know?
Exactly. And that's kind of beautiful in its authenticity, you know, in that kind of acknowledgement that the value is there and it is so high for everyone, you know, for everyone listening, for you guys, for the people that you talk to. It's just amazing, inspiring, and, you know, it exemplifies the power of that community.
Yeah. And it's what we all need, right? Like, you know, it's financially, are we at a loss? Like 100%. But emotionally and like psychologically and community, like we make it, yeah, I'm going to start crying if I think about it too much. We're going to like, there's no reason, like we would never stop doing this because we don't make money off of it. Like, that's not what we're here for. We're trying to cover our costs. Like, we're trying to not like go into debt. But at the end of the day, like, there's so much value that we get from this as well in terms of community and skills. And like, even when I go to Super Feelers obviously every time, and there's so many DBT skills that I had completely forgotten about that I'm starting to use now. And like,
yeah, just having it there as something that is spoken about, that is shared, is normalized. And just the repetition of that and seeing how other people use them and interpret them and meld them together is just exponential. Because, you know, if you're working through it yourself, you're trying to follow a formula, but you're not getting the value of seeing that, oh, actually, they used it in that situation, which would have never occurred to me. And then you might use it in that situation in your life, but you might also be like, oh, this situation is similar to that. So maybe I could use part of that, that, you know, put somebody used, and then part of this other one that somebody used in another situation. And yeah, it just builds off each other in a way that
and
you
we
can't
all have
in
our
isolation.
Favorites.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like my favorites, Dear Man, Wise Mind, Tip Skill, but even Tip Skill, actually, that wasn't my favorite until Super Feelers. Dear Man, Wise Mind, Radical Acceptance. If I were to pick three DBT skills that I use on a regular basis, those would be the three. But Fast, Opposite Action, Tip Skill, Please Skill, which is like the, you know, all of those skills I had completely forgotten existed. And I did DBT pretty like I did my homework every week. You know what I mean? Like, I talk about this stuff every day. And like, you know, I will forever credit the Super Feelers Club for that.
Yeah, because it's, again, it comes back to the safety, the normalization, because like there's all the theories about like if you learn when you feel safe and it's fun, then you learn much quicker and much more effectively. And exactly like you're saying, the things that maybe were most challenging the first time you learned it are the ones that you don't remember because your brain just goes, nope, switch off.
Totally. Yeah, I can't process
it. And it's kind of exactly what you need, but you're not quite ready for it. And then it's not there when you need it unless you're in that situation where it's normalized and repeated and just there as part of life.
Yeah. There's just so much value, you know, just unbelievable amounts of value. So is there anything that we didn't touch on that you were hoping to chat about today?
I don't think so. I think we have had good chat.
We have. You're motivating me to want to publish, and I might need to reach out to you. I think be like, help me.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, definitely worth doing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think probably pitching journals. Is there like a procedural journal? Because I don't know, would that be the most kind of likely to actually publish it? Which is the whole gamble, isn't it, really? You want to go kind of the highest one.
It is a whole gamble.
That is actually likely to publish it.
I started a list of different journals that I thought might. I have to like look into them more. But there's,
because like that sort of thing, I had a quick ping on what sort of UK research there is. And again, there's not very much. But what there is seems to be in kind of nursing journals and things like that.
So yeah.
For the people that would be using these things.
Yeah. So I think what I've looked at is more like psychotherapy journals, even though it's not really therapy, but I think it's like a good treatment to use in addition to therapy. And then there's also a personality disorder specific one. So personality disorders, research, theory, and treatment. Awesome. And I was like, yes, it's niche. So like you may not find as much like reach, but at the same time, like I'm okay with niche because what I'm doing is very niche. So like,
yeah. So you want the people that are specializing in that to be seeing it.
Yeah.
But then it depends how elitist that journal is and all those kind of questions.
And stigmatizing it is, I don't know. Exactly, if they read, you know, oh, this researcher has BPD, are they going to just immediately throw it out? Which is totally possible.
Yeah. Because exactly. It depends which three peers you get, and it's a total gamble and you don't know who they are.
But you don't know till you try, right? So like, yes, it's a pain in the ass to try and like put a manuscript together, but again, the value out, there's no point in it sitting on my computer not being read. It's not.
No, it is value. It's really important research. It gives a precedent and it shows that it exists and it's out there and that it's needed. And, you know, that those kind of, the more that happens and is exemplified, the more that argument of, no, this population is too dangerous, this population has too much ideation, they'll all just talk about self-harm and then riff off each other.
Yeah.
You know, all of that narrative loses weight for every time peer support is talked about in a positive light.
Totally. And every time somebody tries peer support for BPD and realizes that nothing went wrong.
Exactly.
Okay, so I will probably be reaching out to you about publishing at some point because I might need a second set of eyes. But in addition to that, I'm trying to end all my episodes this year with what are your favorite parts about borderline?
I think the intuitive awareness of other people and the depth of pain, but also the potential for joy in the small things.
Wow. That's so well said. I love it. Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kat. It's been a pleasure as always to chat with you, and I hope to see you soon.
Brilliant. No, definitely. Thank you.
Hi, friends. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Bold, Beautiful, Borderline podcast. Lori and I are so grateful that you're here with us on this journey, and we can't wait to dive into more topics in the future with you all about borderline and even have some more fun and exciting guests to join us on the podcast. If you really enjoyed this episode, we would love if you would rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. We would also love to see you interact with us on social media and on our Patreon page. The links to that are included in the show notes, so check us out there. We would be incredibly honored to get to know you all as you get to know us and our recovery stories. We love you, and we'll see you next time.